this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we begin on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Year in Review, 2015 Stories That Mattered, Events and Milestones That Moved the Needle for the Triangle Business Community. And those stories actually make up most of this edition of the Triangle Business Journal in lieu of a particular cover story. So we'll start at the beginning with a look at the biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The main headline, Triangle firms support returning workforce. On December 11, skills training and job placement firm React Hire graduated its first cohort of Raleigh-Durham area professional women ready to restart their careers after being out of the workforce to care for children or family. The company, which was launched in Boston and recently expanded to the Triangle, offers an 8-week training program that includes personal branding, resume writing, project management, collaboration software, social media, data analytics, and coding. After completing the program, women receive contract project assignments at local businesses. Current React Hire partners in the RTP area include Iprio, Fidelity, RTI, Quintiles, and EMC. 43% of women who will exit the workforce at some point in their career to raise a family or care for a loved one, says React Hire CEO Addie Swartz. It's time we make sure these smart, talented women have a clear pathway back in. A career break should not be a career breaker. MasterCard SVP to speak at NAI CareAtlantic event in January. Folks at NAI CareAtlantic are happy with their chosen keynote speaker for the real estate firm's annual Triangle Commercial Real Estate Conference on January 21 at PNC Arena. The invitation-only event will feature prominent business analyst Sarah Quinlan, who is the Senior Vice President at MasterCard Advisors, the analytics arm of MasterCard. Quinlan is a regular on television, especially CNBC, Fox Business Network, and Bloomberg TV. She is a big believer that a demographic shift in how people shop is underway, and that shift likely will change the future of retail. That means small retailers will outsell their larger counterparts as a whole, including this holiday season. According to MasterCard Advisors, small business retail over the past 20 months has accounted for 72.4% of the growth in total retail sales. In the past 12 months, small retailers made up 39.6% of total retail sales. That's the highest penetration MasterCard has seen over any 12-month period since it began tracking the metric in 2004. CareAtlantic founder Steve Stroud, along with President Jimmy Barnes and COO Kerry Saunders, who collectively put the conference together, expect more than 1,800 people to attend the event. What better way to say Merry Christmas than a new Porsche or two? Did you ever wonder, or did you ever consider, giving your loved one a fancy car for the holidays, priced at $1.6 million? Well, for a New York man and his brother who lives in Arizona, that may just be the case, or perhaps it was simply a gift to self. The brothers recently bought two Porsche 918 Spyder vehicles from Cary business-turned-race car driver Jim Taggart for a collective $3.27 million. Taggart, who runs Taggart Auto Sport in Cary, sold his company, Physicians Pharmacy Alliance, to venture capital fund Riverside Company in 2011 and started dabbling in fast cars and auto racing in recent years. What people may not know is that he once bought a 1968 Corvette from none other than Rocky Balboa, that is, Sylvester Stallone. Following the sale of the Porsches, Taggart says the most expensive car currently available at his shop is a 2016 McLaren 675 LT Coupe for a bargain basement price of $525,000. Folks, Santa is still taking requests. The Foundation rings NASDAQ bell to celebrate banner year of funding. The V Foundation for Cancer Research rang the stock market opening bell ceremony at the NASDAQ market site in New York City's Times Square on December 11. George Bodenheimer, retired president and executive chairman of ESPN and a member of the V Foundation's board of directors, rang the bell alongside foundation staff and stakeholders. In celebration of the 9th annual Jimmy V Week, the bell ceremony highlights a record-breaking year for the V Foundation, which awarded more than $20 million in cancer research grants in 2015. It has been a remarkable year at the V Foundation, says Bodenheimer. As we look forward to ringing in another amazing year, we are so honored to participate in the NASDAQ opening bell ceremony. Ray Price, owner of Raleigh Harley Dealership, dies at 78. Ray Price, owner of Ray Price Harley Davidson in Raleigh, died December 16. Price, 78, organized the annual Capital City Bike Fest and numerous runs for charities, including Toys for Tots. According to a TBJ profile in 2000, Price fell in love with Harley motorcycles at age 9 and enjoyed racing as well. He grew the business on South Saunders Street from a small shop to one of the top Harley dealerships, cashing in on affluent baby boomers' fascination with the bikes in the fast-growing Triangle region. "If I sell the business and quit racing, I've got two options," he told TBJ. "One is to sit around and do nothing, which I'm not inclined to do, and the other is to get involved in something else. I don't see the sense in getting involved in something else or something new when this business is what I love." And finally, in a section called You Said It, reader Facebook comments on recent TBJ stories on how Wake County plans to get execs out of their BMWs and into a bus terminal. Chris McGee writes, "Not gonna happen. Widening I-40 and creating a carpool lane would have been much cheaper and effective." And from Philip Johnson, "SkyTran is the only real way to get me out of my BMW. Just saying." And now we turn to On the Beat, 2015's hottest stories, and we start with articles written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Triangle building sales yield record prices. The Triangle commercial real estate market since mid-December 2014 has posted some of its biggest gains in over a decade, with several major property sales setting a new standard for investors entering the market. The sale of the Citrix office building in downtown Raleigh's Warehouse District set a new price per square foot sale record in the Triangle when JMC Holdings LLC of New York City came in with the top bid of $68.5 million for the property. The JMC deal equates to about $370 per square foot for the 185,000 square foot Citrix building that opened in fall 2014 on West Street. The previous Triangle record holder was the 17-story CapTrust Tower at North Hills, which in 2013 sold for $98.4 million or $327 per square foot. The Wake County Revenue Department's octennial reappraisal report released in early December 2015 showed the commercial property values have increased an average 19% countywide compared to property value rates that were set during the last county tax reappraisal in 2008. And much of that new wealth was focused among the market's fast-growing apartment communities. A buyer of three luxury apartment communities developed by Crescent Communities in Raleigh and in Durham from December 2014 through mid-2015 set a new bar for investors of multifamily properties in the region. Boston-based Berkshire Group in December paid $76.8 million or $272,000 per unit for the Crescent Cameron Village apartment building on Oberlin Road in Raleigh. $254,000 per unit for the 303-unit Crescent 9th Street apartment building in Durham in January, and $262,700 per unit for the 208-unit Crescent Main Street apartment building in Durham in July. The previous record for an apartment building in the Triangle had been a week before the Cameron Village property sale, when the Midtown Green Apartments at North Hills was sold for $205,000 per unit. But it didn't have to be a big property to catch investors' attention. The buyer of the former Cafe Helios coffee shop building at 413 Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh also set a new record in 2015 for properties in the Glenwood South Corridor, paying $1.55 million for the 3,180-square-foot building, or $486 per square foot. Downtown development boom in Raleigh and Durham. The downtown cores of both Raleigh and Durham experienced a surge of new capital investments in 2015 that are bringing more people downtown and setting the stage for another wave of property development and redevelopment in 2016 and beyond. In Raleigh, the story was about apartments with more than $170 million invested in the construction of new apartment buildings. The projects have added or will be adding by early 2016 about 1,050 new living units to the Raleigh downtown district. In Durham, the story was about hotels, with about $112 million in new capital invested in the development of about 455 new hotel rooms that have been added in both new and redevelopment buildings in the downtown core. Leaders in both cities are also looking ahead with planning for the next decade of development. Raleigh leaders in 2015 adopted the new Downtown Experience Plan that will help guide planning and development efforts for the city through 2025. Durham downtown leaders are finalizing their draft of a new Downtown Durham Master Plan that's expected to be adopted in 2016. For Raleigh, the apartment surge has at least temporarily led to an overabundance of new studio apartment units, sources in the apartment industry say, but demand for the larger 1- and 2-bedroom units has been meeting expectations as more people choose to move into the city. Among the new high-end rental properties that opened in 2015 include the $60 million, 23-story Sky House Raleigh that was completed in the spring with 323 units, the L, a $17 million apartment project with 83 living units and street-level retail space that wraps around the Way County parking deck at Davy and McDowell Streets as part of a public-private partnership with the county. The Lincoln, a $35 million apartment project near Moore Square with 224 units that opened in the summer. The Link Apartments, Glenwood South, a $30 million apartment project on West Street with 204 apartment units that began moving in residents in late 2015, and Elon City Center, the $30 million apartment project with 213 units on Wilmington Street in the Capital District, will start moving in its first residents in December and open in phases through spring 2016. Downtown Raleigh also opened a fair share of new office and retail properties, adding the $63 million 11-story Charter Square office tower on Fayetteville Street in June. Planning is already underway to add a 22-story office and apartment tower next door. The 227 Fayetteville building, which underwent an $8 million renovation, added its first new tenant in more than a decade when Raleigh-based Vital Source moved in January. In Durham, the cluster of new hotels downtown are already changing the dynamics of tourism in the city. Since prior to 2015, the only hotel option available in the downtown core was at the Durham Marriott City Center on Foster Street. Among the new properties that opened in 2015 include the 21C Museum Hotel, a $48 million redevelopment of the former 15-story SunTrust Bank office tower into 125 upscale hotel rooms, restaurant, and public art museum. The Durham, an $11 million redevelopment of the former Home Services Bank building on East Chapel Hill Street, into 53 boutique-style hotel rooms and a restaurant operated by celebrated Chapel Hill chef Andrea Roising. The Residence Inn by Marriott, a $30 million hotel project on the site of the former McPherson Hotel near the Brightleaf District in Durham. The hotel incorporates part of the old building into its 143-unit property. And the Aloft Durham Downtown Hotel, That's adjacent to the Durham Performing Arts Center and American Tobacco Campus, a $23 million six-story project with 134 rooms and a steakhouse restaurant owned by Durham chef Scott Howell. State sells Dick's property to City of Raleigh. After several years of back-and-forth deal-making between the City of Raleigh and North Carolina state leadership, in July, the city and state finalized the sale of the Dorothea Dix campus for the purpose of converting the property into a landmark destination park on the edge of downtown. Raleigh paid the state $52 million to buy the 308-acre former mental hospital property on a hilltop between Western Boulevard and Centennial Parkway. The state is leasing about 117 acres, with the headquarters building for the State Department of Health and Human Services still in operation on the campus. DHHS is working on a plan to transition its remaining staff off the Dix campus within the next 10 years. Governor Pat McCrory says that likely will involve a public-private partnership with a private real estate development firm to build a new campus for DHHS of about 1 million square feet on state-owned land somewhere in the greater Raleigh area. Negotiations between the city and the state had been ongoing for about 10 years, since shortly after the state decided it would close the hospital that dated back to 1851 on Dix Hill and build a new mental health hospital in Butner, which opened in 2008. In December 2012, former Governor Beverly Perdue signed a lease with the city for the campus, but that deal was rescinded by the state Senate in May 2013. Hiring spree. Financial services firms plan major expansions for tech centers. Four of the world's largest financial services firms, MetLife, Fidelity Investments, Credit Suisse, and Deutsche Bank, solidified their commitments to the Triangle in 2015, with each of the companies announcing major job expansion plans for their technology centers based in the region. MetLife in April and May moved into its new $125 million global technology campus on Weston Parkway in Cary, a two-building project that has already created more than 1,000 high-paying technologist positions in the region. MetLife Chairman and CEO Steve Kandarian, at the ground opening of the campus in Cary, even noted that the company had reached its job creation goals 6 months ahead of schedule. MetLife's 26.5-acre campus also has space to build a third office building. MetLife's move was followed by Credit Suisse's announcement in May that it would be boosting its headcount of 1,600 people in Research Triangle Park by 25%, and quickly. Rob Schaffer, CEO for the Americas, announced the move personally in front of the RTP employees while celebrating the firm's 10-year anniversary in Research Triangle Park. Credit Suisse will be expanding into about 70,000 square feet that the company has subleased in one of the Lenovo campus buildings in Morrisville. Both the RTP-based investment banking support and finance divisions will be relocating to the new facility. Fidelity Investments announced in October that it will be adding 600 more jobs at an expanded office building in Durham, boosting its headcount in the Triangle to 4,200 people. The company will be taking back all of its former office space at the 116,300-square-foot Danbury Hall in Durham after the global financial services firm blew through its hiring goals in nearby Research Triangle Park. Lastly, Deutsche Bank's DB Global Technology Group in September announced that it will be adding another 250 positions to its 400 in Cary. And finally, lawmakers restore tax credit programs. For much of 2015, economic development recruiters and owners of historic properties across North Carolina were on pins and needles waiting to see if the General Assembly would take action to reinstate two popular incentive programs, the Jobs Development Investment Grant, JDIG, and the Historic Tax Credit. It wasn't until September and October that the General Assembly was able to reach an agreement to refund both programs. JDIG's capacity to issue grants was increased from $15 million each year to $20 million. And if a high-yield jobs deal, such as an auto manufacturing plant, were to come to the state, the cap would increase to $35 million. And although the new version of the historic tax credit isn't quite as generous as the previous program, supporters are happy to have it back. The new credit is equal to 10 or 15% of the cost of improvements to income-producing properties, depending on the total cost of the project. Property owners can also receive the entire credit at once instead of spacing it out over several tax years as required under the old program. And the next section of On the Beat 2015's hottest stories include articles written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, Raleigh suffers Salix loss. In April, Quebec's Valiant Pharmaceuticals International Incorporated completed the acquisition of Raleigh Salix Pharmaceuticals, one of the largest pharmaceutical acquisitions in Triangle history. The $11 billion acquisition put a bookend on one of the biggest sagas the Triangle's pharmaceutical industry had ever seen. Salix had made headlines for more than a year before Valiant made its offer. Former CEO Carolyn Logan and former Chief Financial Officer Adam Derbyshire resigned in the wake of inaccurate quarterly reporting that led to an investigation into wholesaler inventory disclosures and accounting concerns by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Logan retired January 30, 2015. Derbyshire resigned November 5, 2014. The disclosure sent its stock price plummeting in late 2014 and scuttled another takeover. Salix had been in the sights of at least two other drug makers, Allergan and Actavis, but those talks fell apart after Salix disclosed problems with how it had been reporting revenue. After adjusting for inventory levels, Valiant began its pursuit and outbid Endo International with its offer of $173 per share in cash. Allergan's offer could have been as high as $205 per share, according to disclosures made after the Valiant acquisition closed. Buried in the deal were golden parachutes in which Logan and Derbyshire made out with a combined $39 million. In total, seven Salix executives received a combined $78 million. The story had other local touchpoints as well. Bob Ingram, who co-led the merger and integration that formed GlaxoSmithKline and lives in Durham, sits on the Valiant board. Mark Sergo, CEO of Raleigh's BioDelivery Sciences International, sat on the Salix board. The day after the acquisition closed, Valiant announced it would lay off 258 workers in North Carolina. Those layoffs didn't come as a total surprise, however, as Valiant's model has long been to acquire companies with promising drugs to sell and focus on selling rather than research and development, especially since Michael Pearson took over in 2008. In both 2013 and 2014, Valiant spent just 3% of its total revenue on R&D. In 2012, it was 2%. By comparison, Salix spent 19% of total revenue on research and development from 2009 through 2013. Even in 2014, when Salix had grown into a more mature drug-selling company, it still pumped $170 million, 15% of total revenue, into R&D. After the acquisition, Valiant secured approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to market the Salix drug Zaxfaxin to treat irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, IBSD, in adult men and women. Already, Zaxfaxin was Salix's biggest seller, and the new indication has driven sales higher. Valiant also launched a direct-to-consumer advertising campaign, including a branded campaign that includes the Salix name and logo, albeit in blue and not its former green. And there are also a couple of lists with this article. First, by the numbers, total value $11.1 billion, price per share $173, layoffs 258, Salix products 22, 13 of which it actively marketed. And also there's a list of the golden parachutes. Thomas DiAlonzo, acting chief executive officer, $3,638,536. William Bertrand Jr., acting chief operating officer, $7,754,238. Timothy Creech, acting chief financial officer, $5,137,516. William Forbes, chief development officer, $11,900,714. Rick Scruggs, executive vice president, business development, $10,492,399. Carolyn Logan, former CEO, $29,586,770. And Adam Derbyshire, former CFO, $9,469,062. And the next headline, Raleigh's Sprout Pharma sells to Valeant for $1 billion cash. Not long after the saga between Quebec's Valeant Pharmaceuticals International Incorporated and Raleigh's Salix Pharmaceuticals ended, the Canadian drug conglomerate made another deal in the triangle when it bought Raleigh-based Sprout Pharmaceuticals for $1 billion in cash. This deal played out much differently than the play for Salix, however. To begin with, Sprout had received U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval for its first drug just 2 days before the acquisition, and Sprout was a considerably smaller company than Salix, which already had 22 approved products on the market at the time of acquisition. Sprout, led by then-CEO Cindy Whitehead, raised $100 million to develop the drug, all from private investors. Sprout makes the top stories of the year not just for the acquisition, but because of the steps it took to receive approval for its drug, Addyi, spelled A-D-D-Y-I, which is the first ever approved drug to treat a sexual disorder in women. The FDA approval is specifically to treat generalized hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, in premenopausal women, but includes serious warnings as well. According to the FDA, Addyi can cause severely low blood pressure and loss of consciousness. These risks are increased and more severe when patients drink alcohol or take Addyi with certain medicines that interfere with the breakdown of Addyi in the body. Addyi is not to be available over the counter, and physicians who want to prescribe the drug must complete a special course. Critics of Addyi have pointed to these side effects as reasons to not approve the drug. Indeed, the FDA denied approval twice, and the Addyi box carries a serious warning label. Since approval of Addyi and acquisition by Valeant, the company has grown by 440%. Sprout now has a sales force of 150 throughout the nation and another 40 workers in the home office in North Hills. Sales for the drug have been slow out of the gate, though executives say that is largely because pharmacy benefits companies are still in the process of putting the drug on their formularies, meaning patients would need to pay full price. They expect sales to increase after patients can use insurance to lower the out-of-pocket costs. A one-month supply costs $20, which is half the price of a Viagra pill. On December 9, Whitehead announced her resignation from Sprout, saying, "I feel like I've seen it through to what I wanted to accomplish." Triangle Hospitals expand services facilities to compete for patients. In 2015, WakeMed Health and Hospitals and UNC Rex Healthcare both made big strides to compete more strongly for patients in and around Wake County. On Mother's Day, WakeMed opened WakeMed North Family Health and Women's Hospital, an expansion of the health system's existing North Healthplex on Falls of Neuse Road. The hospital focuses heavily on women's services, though still sees some male patients as well. Many of the patients will be pregnant or young mothers. The 248,000 8,800 square foot, 61-bed women's hospital at the corner of Falls of Neuse and Durant Roads brings with it new and expanded services. As part of a growing trend nationally, the hospital employs what are called laborists. Already, many health systems employ full-time doctors who work only at the hospital and do not have their own patients in the way a private practice doctor does. These are called hospitalists. In the same way, laborists don't have patients but are available around the clock every day of the year. This way, if a mother's personal doctor is not immediately available when she goes into labor, one of the seven doctors on call will be there to see her. This is the health system's third full-service hospital offering deliveries. More than 7,500 babies are born at WakeMed's hospitals in Raleigh and Cary each year. Though it didn't open in 2015, UNC Rex Healthcare cleared all regulatory hurdles and began construction on its new North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital, a $220 million new hospital at the main campus off Blue Ridge Road. While it won't add any hospital beds, the Heart Tower will bring all of Rex's cardiac care to one place. Rex, a subsidiary of UNC Healthcare, performed 3,100 cardiovascular procedures in 2012, but provides those services in seven different areas on its campus. In some cases, patients must be wheeled nearly a half mile across the campus to move through the process of care. Building the new Heart Tower will not only make things more comfortable to patients, but serve as a draw to cardiac physicians. Rex now competes more strongly for cardiac patients, an area that WakeMed has long been the county's volume leader, and making itself more attractive to top doctors fits within that strategy to compete for market share. University fundraising breaks records. After a string of bull markets on Wall Street, the 2014 to 2015 school year goes down as the best year on record for gifts to the Triangle's biggest universities. Combined, the three universities received a whopping $1.1 billion. During that school year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average increased by 4%, the S&P 500 was up nearly 5%, and the NASDAQ Composite finished a full 12% higher, possibly helping explain the increased giving. How the universities got to their records, however, differed. UNC Chapel Hill received $100 million in a single donation from pharmaceutical magnate Fred Eshelman. That helped bump the total for the year to nearly $447 million in commitments, a 44% jump from the previous year, and beating out the previous records of $343 million set in 2008 by a wide margin. NC State University, on the other hand, could not lean on one individual gift of that size. Instead, gift receipts, an important measure of cash in the door, totaled $119 million, marking the fourth consecutive year receipts have exceeded $100 million. In total, NCSU received $209 million in gifts and pledges last year, a school record, and an 11% increase from the previous year. Duke University bested both UNC and NCSU, pulling in $478 million in philanthropic gifts and contributions during the 2014 to 2015 year. The total private giving to Duke was an 8% increase over what it received in the 2013 to 2014 fiscal year. Feds rule Duke scientist falsified trial results. Duke University closed a dark chapter in its history in 2015. In May, Duke settled all claims arising from junk sciences that stemmed from former Duke researcher Anil Potti. Potti claimed to have found an amazing breakthrough in cancer treatment. The university started a clinical trial in which they tested the treatment on cancer patients. However, Potti's research was later found to be fraudulent, and some of the cancer patients in the trial died. Some of the patients and the estates of patients brought lawsuits against Duke. Attorneys for the plaintiffs cut directly to the point. Defendants admitted they stood to gain three major things if they found something important. One, enhanced reputation. Two, make money. And three, obtain more patients, students, and professors from a tag-on effect. according to a motion filed by Thomas Henson Jr., who represented Walter Jacobs and the estate of Juliet Jacobs, a cancer patient who died after participating in a clinical trial based on the research from Duke. Duke has admitted mistakes. In a January interview, Dr. Robert Califf, the director of the Duke Translational Medicine Institute, who was later nominated by President Obama to become the next U.S. Food and Drug Administration commissioner, reflected on the research that stemmed from Pote's lab. "I wish I had gotten myself more involved earlier," he said. "There were systems that were not adequate, as we stated. That was a tough one, I think, for the whole institution." In November, the federal government officially ruled that Pote had falsified research. Although more than 10 of his research papers had already been retracted, this marked the official declaration. The ruling from the Office of Research Integrity, ORI, found that Pote engaged in research misconduct by including false research data in published papers, submitted manuscript, grant application, and the research record. Pote reached a settlement with ORI, though did not admit to or deny the findings. Pote has not participated in U.S. Public Health Service, PHS, supported research since 2010, and said he does not intend to apply for research supported by PHS in the future, according to the settlement. And now in On the Beat, 2015's hottest stories in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to stories by Lauren Onasorge. The big headline, Bronto's big deal, Durham startup acquired by tech giant NetSuite. It was 9 a.m. on April 23 when the crowd huddled outside for what they thought was just a Bronto group photo. Bronto CEO Joe Colopy and Chief Operating Officer Chaz Felix came up with the idea the day before. They wanted all their Durham employees in one place for the news. That California tech giant NetSuite had acquired the email marketer for a cool $200 million. At the time when a photographer typically says, say cheese, Colopy announced the buyout. And those resulting cheers were just part of the pattern. In 2015, where at American Tobacco Campus alone, six companies met with high-profile exits, two Toasters, Ticketmaster, Automated Insights, Stats, Appia, Digital Turbine, Square One Bank, PacWest, Ansible, Red Hat, and Bronto, NetSuite. Michael Goodman, Vice President of Real Estate at Capital Broadcasting, which owns American Tobacco, says the trend hasn't exactly been exits. That's because the companies being bought out at American Tobacco aren't exactly exiting. They want to stick around, he says, pointing to the fact that growth, not layoffs, have been the normal result of the buys over the past few months. Take Bronto, which had 288 employees in November, up from 255 when it was acquired. And national brands have even consolidated other operations here, such as what Digital Turbine has done in the months following its closure of its deal with Appia. It's a banner year that has spilled outside of downtown Durham as another Bull City entity, Sioderm, made a big splash selling Amicus Therapeutics in a deal worth up to $947 million. And it's not just upstart companies making the headlines. Yatkin Financial, fresh off its 2014 combination with Vantage South, announced plans in October to merge with Greensboro-based New Bridge Bank, a deal that makes a $7.1 billion bank, increasing Yatkin's lead as largest community bank in the state. But not every deal has resulted in immediate growth. After Canadian drug developer Valeant closed on its buy of Raleigh gastrointestinal drug maker Salix Pharmaceuticals for $11 billion, Valeant laid off 258 employees. And when another Canadian firm, Couch Tard, closed on its buy of Kerry-based convenience chain The Pantry, 250 local jobs were immediately cut. But silver linings still followed. Valeant purchased another Raleigh drug developer, Female Libido Pharma Sprout Pharmaceuticals, for $1 billion, pledging local hires. And the pantry may have consolidated operations, but Daryl Davis, Senior Vice President of Operations, says a bullish rebranding campaign targeted for January will reinvigorate the company and advance what he calls a local culture across the chain. In some years, Sprouts' buyout would easily classify as the deal to end all deals, but not in 2015. That title goes to a small Chapel Hill-based drug developer many people hadn't heard of before November, Cardioxyl. In November, pharma giant Bristol-Myers Squibb Company disclosed it would be acquiring the company in a deal that, should all milestones be achieved, would be worth more than $2 billion. Cree launches power spinout. Eyes are on Durham LED developer Cree going into 2016. The Durham-based public company, born in the 1980s out of NC State University, now 7,000 employees strong, captured President Barack Obama's attention last year for its next-generation technology. But drastic changes in product pricing, industry shifts, and lackluster demand has Cree management struggling to write down top-line revenue. The stock price today is about where it was 10 years ago. CEO Chuck Swoboda has asked repeatedly for patience, insisting that the world will buy into Cree's LED bulbs, bulbs that even at a modest $8 still outcost their most expensive traditional equivalent. He also insists that the market, inflated with component supply from overseas, will stabilize and pricing will be on Cree's side once again. But Cree's LED and lighting businesses are not the only shops, analysts, and investors will be watching next year. Facing both stock and margin pressures, the company is preparing to spin off its power and radio frequency business in 2016. Dubbed Wolfspeed, the new public company will still have Cree as a majority owner, and it will still operate from the Durham complex where it has been creating power devices. It will just be under a new moniker, with Cree board member Frank Plastina leading the company. Google Fiber confirms Triangle plans. After months of toying with the Triangle in other communities across the country, Google made it official in January. Google Fiber is officially coming to the Triangle. The remaining question was, when? Nearly a year later, that's still the question. Google still isn't giving any specific details about the scope and timing of its plan for the Triangle. While Google Fiber confirmed it had broken ground in Raleigh in November, officials connected to the construction efforts say it's easily 2 years until customers can actually sign on. In the meantime, other players have stepped up with service offerings, such as AT&T and Frontier Communications. New players have announced plans too, such as Ting, which is coming exclusively to Holly Springs. But disappointments have also been part of the 2015 fiber story. Wake Forest was the first to get a solid yes from a company. RST Fiber of Shelby started loading its crews into the community and dug trenches in 2014. Initially, the company told town officials they'd have fiber lines in place and connected to homes in the summer of 2014. In spring of 2015, however, town officials started to realize it just wasn't materializing. Their calls went unanswered for months before Deputy Town Manager Roe O'Donnell announced the town was cutting ties with RST and going back to the fiber drawing board. And finally, new faces join C-suite management at RTP. In Research Triangle Park, new faces are leading the sprawling campuses at IBM, NetApp, and EMC, and they're a lot different from what you may be used to when it comes to technology. It starts at IBM, whose site lead, Bob Greenberg, retired, putting Fran O'Sullivan in charge. After NetApp's Rich Clifton retired, longtime exec Denise Cox became the senior-most NetApper at RTP. And Bob Hawkins' retirement put Carol Flack in charge of the local EMC headcount in September. Put them together, and three women are in charge of thousands of tech employees in Research Triangle Park. In an industry where females are statistically outnumbered in the C-suite, it's a big deal, and it's not lost on execs such as Cox. I don't know why there aren't more women, she says, adding that positive steps in education and more access to mentors are two ways to narrow that gender gap. But other changes too hit RTP, such as longtime exec Jay Parker of Lenovo. Shortly after being promoted to enterprise chief at Lenovo's RTP-based server business, he left for a role at competing electronics firm Dell. Lenovo, which has shuffled its headcount multiple times since acquiring the PC business 10 years ago from IBM, has several executives over different divisions in RTP and Morrisville, such as Aymar D. Lequensang, the recently tapped head of North America. Its senior-most RTP-based exec is now CTO Peter Hortensius. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, and we start with the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Time for Airlines to Cut Passengers a Fair Deal. Yes, I get it. Profit is good. It allows companies to hire workers, strengthen their business models and scope, put money in owners' pockets. After all, profit promotes consumer spending, the linchpin for a strong economy. But after reviewing the third quarter financials of U.S. airlines, it is hard to believe why air carriers are not giving a break to the flying passenger with these ever-increasing fees for baggage, reservation changes, seat allocation, food, and various other sundries. Just days ago, the U.S. Department of Transportation revealed the third quarter financials of 25 U.S.-based airlines and concluded, net income for these carriers have nearly tripled in the quarter when compared to last year, from $3.1 billion to $9.2 billion. United Airlines accounted for more than half of those profits. Operating profits were $8.8 billion, up 61% from a year earlier. Baggage fees for the quarter were more than $1 billion, a 25% increase from same time last year. Reservation change fees have remained unchanged at about $750 million. Fuel costs during the quarter have dropped 38% when compared to same time last year, from $11.4 billion to $7 billion. Labor costs have increased marginally from $10.4 billion to $11.8 billion. With decade-low fuel prices and a higher demand for fewer available seats, these are the good times for the air carriers. But as history tells us about the aviation business, this too will not last. Perhaps that's why Delta, AA, U.S. Air, United, and others are reaping the profits as much as they can right now. There is money to be made everywhere right now in the airline business. Southwest Airlines, which does not charge for baggage or reservation changes, made $584 million last quarter, up from $329 million a year ago. But when the industry enters the down cycle and the supply of passengers are at a premium, let's see how long these surcharges last. Because customers' satisfaction cannot be any lower right now, good for United to bring back free snacks on its domestic flights. This time around, however, after paying billions of dollars in baggage fees every quarter, passengers deserve something more than a bag of pretzels. And also we have another Viewpoint column written by Mark Sutter, who is the editor of the Triad Business Journal. The headline, Whether in Print or Online, Facts Matter. In Facebook terms, shared means he didn't write the post, but thought well enough of its content that he decided to copy it to his own page so it could be seen by his online friends, which number a few hundred. Think Before You Donate was the simple title, and who could argue with that, right? People want to make sure that when they donate, their money reaches the people and causes they intend to help. Problem is, nearly nothing in this post was true. Statistics used to make cases for and against certain charities were either wrong, badly dated, or both. Mostly wrong. For instance, the Post made the claim that for every dollar given to the March of Dimes, literally only a dime went to its charitable programs. It took me only a minute on Google to find out that, one, that the March of Dimes program expense rate is closer to 70%, and two, that this particular post, which also criticizes the American Red Cross, United Way, Goodwill, and UNICEF, has been hanging around the web since at least 2005. I understand the March of Dimes bit may go back decades, long before the internet. My friend wasn't the only one who passed it on. Facebook indicated this particular post had been shared 5,412 times. That means if everyone who shared it has 100 friends, it was potentially viewed by 541,200 people. But it really doesn't stop there. If you know anything about Facebook and the web, you understand that these things live in multiple forms and forever. It's easy to imagine that during the past 10 years, the number of potential views of this item or a similar one is easily in the millions. I should stop here to say that while I am singling out this particular post, it represents what has seemed to me to be a non-stop flow of posts and forwarded emails I've seen through the years. Oh, sure, I'm used to seeing lots of opinion posts and emails, particularly of the political variety. And okay, if people want to express their dislike of Obama or Rubio, have at it. I figure as long as it's an opinion and it makes them feel better by passing along something negative, fine. But what I am struck by is the proliferation of items, like the charity post, that are presented as facts and just aren't. As debaters are fond of saying, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. People in the media are particularly sensitive to accusations that they are biased or pass along false information, and yet, ironically, so many people online, when given the chance to be gatekeepers themselves, pass along information via Facebook shares, forwarded emails and tweets, apparently without feeling any obligation themselves to verify accuracy. In the case of the charity post, it potentially harms not just the organizations, but the worthy people who might stand to benefit from the donations. And why? Better yet, who in the world takes the time to create such things in the first place? That, to me, is the real mind-boggler. Think about it. It took some real effort to put together that post, complete with a fairly complicated chart, by the way, and denigrate those charities. What could the original motives possibly be? Who did it? We may never know, but it just seems like real evil to me. Unfortunately, many of us are aiding these efforts intentionally or not. My friend meant no harm. He felt he was passing on some good advice, a word to the wise, as it were. I felt bad scolding him for the post, though scold him I did. It's just that it is so easy nowadays to simply click like or share or forward or retweet, and easier yet to just let things like that stand without challenge. But that shouldn't excuse the duty to make sure we are reasonably sure information is true and the sources are known and trusted. It's what people expect of the media, and rightly so. But in this internet age, it's a standard everyone needs to hold themselves to as well. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move page. And the spotlight is on Jonathan Peeler, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities Management at North Carolina Central University. Laboring in a career that has taken him to far-off locales, Jonathan Peeler has been tapped as the new Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities Management at North Carolina Central University. Peeler's previous work in facilities maintenance, operations, and management was at the Ross University School of Veterinary Medicine in St. Kitts, West Indies, as well as closer to home at NC State University. Of his latest move, Peeler, a Lincolnton native, says he wanted to get back to North Carolina to be closer to family. And this job was a great fit with a challenging opportunity, he says. Peeler is now responsible for directing all aspects of the facilities and capital projects program on the NCCU campus, including planning, land acquisition, landscape design, engineering, and other areas. NCCU currently boasts a total enrollment of 8,018 and a total employee base of nearly 1,500. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? This position requires a good mix of managerial skills, interpersonal skills, and thorough understanding of skilled trades to be successful. What are some of your major goals for your new position? To increase employee engagement, revise the long-range master plan, and lead an expansion of the campus, and to provide well-maintained facilities to enhance the student experience. Education, bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, and a master's degree in civil engineering from NC State University. Biggest pet peeve, underperformance or lack of sense of urgency by colleagues. Biggest worry, a campus emergency affecting campus operations. Triangle business person you most admire. The late William Friday, past UNC system president. And latest book you've read, Crucial Conversations by Carrie Patterson and Joseph Grenny. And in our final minutes in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read as much as we can of this other article, Raleigh's Union Station Construction Begins. Raleigh's Union Station project is proceeding despite the October announcement by an advisory committee that Wake County's transit plan should focus more on bus transportation and less on rail. In November, the Raleigh City Council voted to approve a $7.2 million increase to the budget for the construction of the facility, raising the total project budget to $54.7 million. The extra funding was necessary to accommodate increased construction costs. The station, to be constructed as a joint venture between Clancy and Thays and Skanska, is intended to serve as a hub connecting Raleigh's multiple transportation modes, including Raleigh Bus Service, Triangle Transit Regional Bus Service, Amtrak Rail Service, and any future local and regional rail transit. After the November funding boost, Raleigh City Manager Ruffin Hall emphasized that the county remains committed to rail. "It's a matter of timing," Hall says. "Rail is still part of the county's 10-year funding plan, but they're going to move that down the timeline." The station is being constructed at the site of a former warehouse on the west end of Martin Street in downtown Raleigh. It will replace the existing and often overcrowded Amtrak station on Cabarrus Street, and it's anticipated. And we'll stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.